A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on September 29, 1991, entitled East of Eden, Judgment and Grace. The scripture reading is Genesis 4, verses 1 through 16. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 4, verses 6 through 7 and 15 through 16. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Last Sunday, I invited you to linger with me in Eden, to luxuriate for a time in the lush of that garden that God planted in order to have a place of delight in which to place the creature that God had formed in God's own image. I confess to you that I had never lingered in Eden. I had always seen chapter 2 of Genesis as a setup for chapter 3. I had always rushed through the garden to the tree, to the act of disobedience and the subsequent expulsion from the garden. And then it dawned on me that the Garden of Eden, Eden which means literally delight, was reflective in that biblical story of the intention of God, that God's people would indeed dwell in delight, that God is a God who delights to delight God's people and who delights in the delight of His people. And so we lingered there for a bit and simply savored that environment of loving graciousness. That came about because we were thinking about the children, and we are really rethinking everything here, trying to find the stories that will shape a new generation, those biblical stories that will stamp our children. And it dawned on me that I wanted, too late for my children. Sorry, kids. I get so late smart. But for my grandchildren, I wanted them, first of all, before they learned anything else, to be marked by the delight of God in them. I had told you previously many times that you couldn't separate Genesis 2 from Genesis 3, that the chapter separations are artificial, that it's really one story. So I really violated my own rule last week as I kept us in Genesis 2 and simply savored the delight of God who delights in our delight. But I know, as well as you know, and our children know as well, that all is not delight. And one day, our little ones, though marked with that strong strain of delight, I trust, will look us in the eye and say, Mother, Father, Grandpa, Grandma, why isn't it really that way? Why is there sadness in the world? Why is there trouble? What's wrong? And when they come to the realization that the delight that is the Creator's intention is a delight that has been lost by the Creator's creatures, then we have more stories to tell them. Then we will have to go on and tell them the story of chapter 3 of Adam and Eve and the tree and the fruit and the serpent and the disobedience and the expulsion the alienation and the pain. But we won't only tell them that story as though that story stamps everything that follows. We will tell them four stories. And just as Colette has designed a beautiful story about Eden's delight for the children, so she has designed another story which incorporates the four stories of those first 11 chapters of Genesis. Not that any one of them is not enough for a story a full week, but because what we want to say to the children is that all four of those stories are really saying essentially the same thing. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, which we just read a moment ago, Noah and the flood and the ark and the Tower of Babel, Eden with Adam and Eve, the brokenness between the man and the woman, Cain and Abel, the brokenness between brothers and sisters, the flood story, the unrighteousness in society as a whole, and the tower story, the human grasping after the prerogatives of God. We'll tell them all four stories, and we'll tell them all four stories in order that they might see that those first 11 chapters of Genesis are dealing with universal human themes, and that they all essentially say God's intention, and that marvelous and perilous gift of freedom with which the creature is endowed, created in God's own image, and the choices before which the creature stands, and the consequences of the choices that human persons make. In order to adequately tell them that, I'll need your help as they come to you. And if you're going to help them, I'm going to help you unlearn something. Are you ready? For many years, I have been preaching and teaching from these chapters and have tried to make it clear that these stories are symbolic stories. They're not history. They're prehistory. There wasn't a garden with a tree and a snake and a Mr. Adam and a Mrs. Eve. There weren't two brothers named Cain and Abel. And every ancient civilization has the story of a disastrous flood, but certainly there was never a flood that covered the whole earth. And the Tower of Babel, well, probably the image of some Babylonian temple was the source of that story. Those stories are pictures. They are images. They are meant to teach us profound and ultimate truths. I have been saying that for a long time. But there is one thing about which I myself am just really now coming to clarity about. Even though I have treated them all on a symbolical level, I have still created the impression, I think, which is the traditional understanding of things, that there was a period of human innocence and then a moment of fall. I no longer believe that. I think, rather, there are four stories with a human person created in the image of God, with freedom of choice, with a call to obedience and the opportunity for disobedience, with disobedience being the constant refrain and the consequences thereof, bringing all of the alienation and estrangement and pain to the human situation. It is not as though there was an initial trial period in blissful innocence. The human couple, not yet confirmed in goodness, yet innocent. The wrong choice being made, they being marked from that point on as fallen, and all that stemmed from them as fallen. That is a theological explanation, and it really needs some reworking for two reasons. From the understanding of the nature of the story itself, the biblical story itself, and also from our understanding of human personality as we do understand the human person today in the light of all that is available to us in the study of the human being. For those two reasons, we have to rethink. And as we rethink, let me suggest to you that there is a doctrine that we should put on the shelf. Are you ready? It is the doctrine of original sin. Let's do away with it. Let's do away with it and then see whether or not we cannot make better sense of what we actually experience as human beings before the face of God. Now let me be very clear. In doing away with the doctrine of original sin, I am doing away with the idea that there was an original sin that then infected the rest of the race so that everyone was marked by sin from that original moment. I am not whitewashing human nature. I am not undercutting the seriousness of human perversity. I am not saying anything about the human condition as not conditioned by the perverse choices that have been made and that are continually being made. But rather than the image of Adam and Eve walking on a plateau and coming to a cliff and falling and stamping the rest of the race from that moment, how about if we took the image of the human person standing before a fork in the road with a choice required, the consequences of which will surely be reaped? What if we see the human person standing always, every person, every day, before life's choices? What if we see ourselves as being called again and again and again to choose the good and to eschew the evil? Let's just take one of the stories for a few moments. The story we read together, Cain and Abel. The story is not told as though Adam and Eve having sinned, now inevitably there would be the consequences of sin in the next generation. That is to historicize the story, to lose its symbolic character. It is a fresh story, even though the narrator connects the stories. And we have, if we just take the story, two brothers, Cain and Abel. Cain is a farmer raising crops, and Abel is a herdsman raising flocks. They both offer sacrifices. Cain's offering is not accepted, and Abel is accepted. Now you go back and read the story. That's all it says. You can go to the New Testament and find some commentary on that, but that's all added. And the New Testament commentary comes out of late Judaism with its commentary. The story, as it's told in the record we have, is of two brothers, both of whom sacrifice, one of whom is accepted, and one of whom is not. Now, the one who is not has his countenance fall. He becomes depressed. And he's angry. Well, might you have been angry? Might we be able to understand Cain's anger? God comes to him and says, "Why is your face fallen, Cain?" Well, if anybody ought to know, you should. "Why are you angry, Cain? Tell me." In the story, do you get a little uneasy with God? I mean, it doesn't seem fair. Why is one accepted, another not accepted? With no reason given, isn't there the feeling of a bit of arbitrariness here? Isn't there kind of a capricious streak then in God? Well, it's interesting. The Lord says to Cain, "Cain, I want to tell you that you are at a point of great peril. Your soul is in danger. Sin is like a demon crouching at the door of your soul, ready to consume you. And you must master it." That's the story, at least in its first act. I wonder if the biblical writer is simply mirroring what we all really know. Isn't there a kind of arbitrariness about life? Isn't there kind of a capricious strain in life? Tell me. In a family of three or four kids, were you the homely one? Do you have a brother or sister that never cracked a book and got all A's, and you slaved and had to work real hard to get C's? Anybody out there this morning angry because you haven't gotten a square deal? Do you know the experience at all of working hard, keeping your nose clean, doing the absolute best you can, and coming up short when some irresponsible coot seems to go blithely through life with everything coming up roses? They tell us in child development that children go through a stage where they really see life in black and white. If you are good, good things happen. If you are bad, bad things happen. If I do well, I should be rewarded. If I do poorly, I deserve the consequences. And a lot of us really drag remnants of that into our adulthood. But life isn't really that way, is it? Come on, be honest. Life isn't fair. And there are some of you out there this morning are very angry about it, but you've never dared admit it, not to yourself, and you've certainly never dared shake your fist at heaven and said, "Why?" But the story of Cain and Abel, if we just take it at face value, says there is a kind of mysterious something about life that doesn't make sense. And then the story says, and that's precisely the moment, man or woman, that you are in the greatest peril of your soul that you will ever be in. Because precisely at that moment, if you yield to that anger, to that depression, to that discontent, and if you act out your anger and your depression, you will suffer alienation and you will find yourself estranged from your fellow humankind and from God. You will go out from the presence of the Lord and you will dwell east of Eden. You stand at a fork in the road. And should you be able, nonetheless, in the face of what is humanly unfair and without explanation, trust God, trust God's goodness, trust God's grace, you will be blessed. Cain said, "Hey, Abel, let's take a hike." And they got out in the back 40, and Cain killed his brother Abel. What are you going to do with your anger, Abel? What are you going to do with your anger, Cain? I'm going to kill my brother. And Cain, you have the freedom to kill your brother. You have the freedom to say it is not fair, it doesn't make sense, and I'll kill him. And he did. And how much of the human story is not filled with the drama of those who have been so angered about life's apparent injustice and capriciousness and arbitrariness? The kid as homely as a hedge fence who never gets a break. The brother or the sister who can't ever measure up. The adult who goes through life and never sees anything turn to gold. And all of that building up, building up, building up, creating within us negativity and hostility, finally erupting into all kinds of violence. That is the fork in the road before which we are constantly standing. And its consequence is bitter. We go out from the presence of the Lord. Our brother is dead. And we are afraid at every creak in the floor. Cain brought his agony to God. God said, "I'll mark you. No one is to touch Cain." Because the last word is not our alienation and its eruption in violence. The last word is grace. Just as God clothed Adam and Eve as they left the garden, so God marked Cain with protective grace. Because we may stand before the fork of the road and we may choose wrongly, and we may find ourselves east of Eden, but never beyond the pale of God's grace. But God has given us that awful, wonderful, scary gift of freedom. And the story of Adam and Eve is not the story of a human couple long ago, but is our story every day. It is the very structure of our human nature. We who are related to all that is below us, with all of the animal aggression, all of that is a part of the constitution of being human. also indwelt by the Spirit of God who would lift us heavenward, constantly in that conflict between that pull from below and that beckoning from above, called always to choose, to trust, to rest in a mystery that we cannot fathom, in a God out of whose grasp we can never fall. But in the meantime, east of Eden is a long way from Eden's delight. Come home, you who are struggling and angry, and you who are rebelling inwardly, whether you've ever admitted it or not, come home. Like that other father's two sons, the one in the far country who came to himself and came home and found the embrace of the father. And not like the other who, coming in from the fields, pouted at the party, angry because it wasn't fair, and remained forever outside. Finally, you see, it's our choice. And the beckoning arms of God simply say to us, come here and let me love you. And one day, you'll understand. Thanks be to God.